So as a reminder of where we left off yesterday afternoon, we've explored starting assumptions for where we might start looking for dark matter. So, you know, as I was telling you yesterday, there's kind of a very big mass range that we could start, you know, that the dark matter can actually be in. And so we want to pick a range that appears to be well motivated and is a good starting point to start to begin exploring. And so that is going to be the weekly interacting dark matter scenario. So yesterday we looked at the we considered the freeze out procedure. We saw that if you have thermally produced dark matter that's roughly around 100 GeV weekly interacting, you could get the right dark matter abundance today. And that you can get these weekly interacting dark matter particles in the context of many theoretical models, and especially in the context of supersymmetry, which is one of the reasons why this paradigm has gained so much momentum. So what we're going to do today is explore some of the experimental consequences of starting at this with this hypothesis. And the first thing we're going to consider in the morning session is direct detection experiments. So the basic premise here is that, you know, we're standing here on Earth and there's just billions of dark matter particles that are streaming through us, right through the Earth. And so let's take advantage of it. Let's build a chunk of crystal or something like that, put it deep underground, and just wait. And what we're waiting for is one of these dark matter particles to hit the nuclei in these detectors. And in that collision, the nucleus will jiggle a little bit, emit some energy, and then we hope to be able to detect that energy and from it infer the mass of the invisible dark matter particle that came in and collided with it. So there's a whole host of these experiments that are ongoing now. And by the end of the lecture, I hope that you'll have some intuition for how to actually calculate rates for these experiments, what they're looking for, and then we'll discuss in some more detail what the current constraints are from the experiments. So the most important quantity for these types of searches is essentially the scattering rate, right? Dark matter particle comes in, scatters off the nucleus. We want to know how often that's going to happen. So this scattering rate, I'm going to write in terms of this is going to be the recoil energy of the nucleus. And so the scattering rate is just going to be equal to the number density of the dark matter times the velocity average differential cross-section for the scattering to occur. And then for the total rate, we'd want to multiply by the number of target nuclei in the experiment. So just to kind of give you a sense of the history behind these ideas, this approach was first proposed by Goodman and Witten. In the 80s. And, in their paper, they just kind of put forth this proposal and did some estimates for what the rate would be and found that it was large enough that this was something that was worth considering in more detail. Their paper was followed by one by Drucker, Fries, and Spergel that fleshed out the idea in a lot more detail. So their paper was the first one to sort of start including the velocity distribution for the dark matter. They also had a proposal for how you would actually build an experiment. This was also 80s. But Yeah, so the combination of these two papers really kind of set forward this experimental program for the next 20, 30 years since then. Okay, so this is essentially what we're going to be spending the next hour just gaining some intuition for. I'm going to write this out more fully. So number of targets. I'm going to write this out just as number energy density for the dark matter divided by its mass. And this average is an integral over velocity. And I put in my distribution function for the velocity of the dark matter. Then there's another factor of V, and then there's the d sigma der. So I have to do this integral, right, over all allowed velocities for the dark matter. Let's start off by just thinking so we're going to have a V max and a V min. So let's start off by thinking what's setting the V max in this case. What's the maximum velocity that a dark matter particle can have that we'd expect to see? Yeah, it's escape velocity in the Milky Way, right? So if a dark matter particle is zipping around with a velocity larger than the escape velocity, then it will just leave the Milky Way, and so we wouldn't expect to see it. So Vmax is just the escape velocity in the Milky Way. How would we know what the escape velocity of a dark matter particle is in the Milky Way? Is that something we can actually measure? Yes. Yeah. So we can estimate because we know roughly the mass of the Milky Way. Can we get an observational constraint to make sure that our estimate is correct? Sure. Yeah. So what would we use? Hint. Think back to the first approximation we did in class this time exactly 24 hours ago. When you were estimating what serves as a good tracer for dark matter? Stars, yeah. So we look for the fastest stars that we see in the halo. And people have done this. The best limits right now come from the RAVE survey. And so roughly we think the escape is somewhere between 450 to like 650. Kilometers per second. Okay, so that's setting the maximum for this integration. The minimum here is being set by kinematics. So let's just kind of set up the kinematics for this problem. And fortunately, this actually isn't going to be very complicated. Actually, most of the stuff that we're going to do over the next two lectures only relies on non-relativistic interactions. And in particular, this scattering isn't much different than scattering of two balls that you did freshman physics. Okay, so. The question here is, what is the minimum velocity that the dark matter particle needs in order to give a nuclear recoil of given energy, of, you know, just this given energy? We measure that energy, and we kind of want to work backwards to know what the minimum velocity is that you would need to get that energy. So just setting up the kinematics, the initial state, right, is just going to be my dark matter particle coming in, and my nucleus, which is at rest. And then the final state after the scatter, I've got my nucleus recoiling off and my dark matter also recoiling off. So let's see. So let's call this, its momentum P2, the initial momentum of the nucleus is P1. The recoil momentum is P3 for the nucleus. And for the dark matter here, we're not really going to care that much because this isn't, we can never actually observe that momentum, but we'll call it P4 for now. Okay, so the momentum transfer in this collision is Q. I'm going to define it as little q. And right, it's just that. So just to get you thinking about this a little bit, for the first exercise, I want you to spend just a few minutes just writing down what P1, P2, and P3 are. So, and then getting an expression for the momentum transfer. In terms of the recoil energy of the nucleus. Okay, so let's, I'll just kind of sketch this out on the board as you're kind of finishing that up. So the important thing to remember here is that this is just all non-relativistic. So the nucleus here is just starting at rest. Dark matter is also non-relativistic, so we can just write this simply. And the magnitude of the momentum transfer in this case, So this is just going to be equal to twice the mass of the nucleus times the recoil energy, okay? So if I wanted to write down a four vector for the momentum transfer, then it is just going to be the recoil energy and then the following. So once you have this, it's a fairly straightforward exercise, just a bit of algebra, to actually solve for what this minimum velocity is. So that might actually make a nice little exercise for the afternoon session. And I will just give you what the final result is. So this minimum scattering velocity is as follows. So I'm going to give you the most general form, and then we consider it in pieces. So the denominator here, this is the reduced mass of the nucleus and the dark matter. And this delta is a mass splitting. So I'm considering a general form here for the minimum velocity that allows for the fact that the dark matter might actually upscatter in the interaction. So for example, maybe it comes in initially, it has mass m chi, and let's say for some reason there's another state, another dark matter state that's very close in mass to this one. After it scatters, if it's an inelastic scattering event, it might upscatter to this other state. And so I'm going to take the mass splitting between this. So like if this were the dark matter spectrum, I'd have my bottom state just m chi, and then the next state would be m chi plus delta. So in the case of purely elastic scattering, then delta is equal to zero. And that's the scenario that's considered most often. But good to kind of keep in mind how things can vary if you change up what's going on in that dark sector. All right, so once we have this, then we can just go here and actually evaluate what the rate is. Very kind of back of the envelope at first, and then we're going to do this more carefully for particular dark matter interactions. But this is just going to be proportional to this integral, right, v escape. In many cases, and we're going to show this explicitly later, the differential cross-section here is proportional to 1 over v squared. So it turns the integral into that, okay? And we'll show this in a little bit. Okay. So if I'm just going to start from basic assumptions, right? My basic assumption for the velocity distribution was that it should have what form? This was from yesterday. Yeah, Maxwell-Boltzmann. So I'm going to substitute in here e to the minus v squared over v naught squared. Simple integral to do. What you get is something that looks like this. So essentially, we're doing an integral of v f of v, velocity here, right? It's going to have this v f of v. If I'm taking f of v to be a Maxwell-Boltzmann, it looks something like this. And then I'm doing this integration from, I don't know where the colored chalk is, but from some minimum value up, right? So this is what the integration will look like if I happen to have a lower mass dark matter. What happens as I increase the mass of the dark matter particle? Yeah, so V min should be smaller or larger than what I just drew here? Smaller, yeah. So if I increase if I increase my mass, then the integration, yes, awesome, thanks. Okay, then I'm integrating over a much bigger region. So in general then, the rate will tend to be higher if the scattering is occurring with a heavier mass dark matter, which makes sense intuitively, right? Because if you have some heavier mass dark matter particle that hits your nuclei, you expect the nuclei to have larger energy. But now you can kind of see it explicitly just in terms of the region that we're integrating this curve over. So now you should have, with this, I've given you enough information that somebody could hire you as a consultant on one of these experiments. And you can advise them on what kind of targets they should be using to look for particular kinds of dark matter particles. All right, so imagine that you're hired as a consultant and your job is, some theorist come up with a new model and says the dark matter is 10 GeV. For sure, it's 10 GeV. So the goal is to design an experiment that can discover a 10 GeV dark matter particle, okay? And you have two options. You can either recommend that they use a target made out of germanium, or you can recommend that they use a target made out of xenon. So ignoring any experimental challenges in terms of actually using germanium or xenon, maybe just discuss amongst yourselves for a few minutes which one of the two you would actually put forth as the recommendation for what they should be using to look for a 10 GeV dark matter candidate. Or if it's so obvious, you can yell it out. Either way.
Oh, this is yours. So if it's 32 versus 15 for me, so this should be about
I was wondering how long it was going to take before somebody asked.
No, you're gonna. We all have Google these days.
All right. Tough.
Might as well put a computer to be used. I think Wikipedia has the mass of xenon and the mass of germanium. You can also use your knowledge of the alphabet, by the way. For who is the...
I think that's...
So are people ready to get paid their consultant fee to pick something? We have a vote for germanium. More votes for germanium. Even more votes for germanium. Awesome. Okay. Votes for xenon. Oh, okay. So what's the what's your rationale for germanium?
Both a
atomic masses that are significantly higher than 10 GeV.
Mm-hmm.
So then your reduced mass can be about 1.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have it go like, the Vmin goes like square root of Ma.
Yep.
So then you want to make Vmin as small as possible, so you want the lighter one.
Yep. So yeah, because you want to make Vmin as small as possible, you're going to want the lighter of the two targets. Yeah?
Do you have any clear any Vmax effects? Is that because it's generally much larger than the distribution?
Sorry?
Yeah, we included the escape velocity in this.
Oh, yeah. Okay, good. Thank you, actually. That's a good point. Let's put in some velocity scales here. So this peak occurs roughly around 220 kilometers per second. It's being set by the velocity of the sun as it's orbiting the center of the Milky Way. So the cutoff for Vmax would tend to be here, because it would be roughly around 500. So variations in the escape velocity, because like I said, we don't know it exactly, will change the final answer, but not by very much, because you're only just slightly changing what the cutoff is here. That being said, so for a given target, so let's say now I've chosen germanium, and as I keep exploring lower, let's say you do the first experiment, it's not 10 GeV, so the theorist comes back and said, oops, no, maybe it should be at 1. Where's my Vmin then? Does it move lower or higher?
Higher.
Higher, right? Yeah, so as I lower my, as I lower the mass of my dark matter particle, the minimum velocity to scatter is higher. And as it gets higher, my integration is only over the very tail of the distribution. So I start becoming much more sensitive to assumptions that I make about the escape velocity or assumptions that I'm making about exactly how this fall off is happening. So as you go to lighter dark matter, you tend to become more sensitive to these astrophysical assumptions for this reason. For heavier dark matter, because you're doing the integration over this full region, you're not very sensitive to effects in the tail. Okay, great. So what does the differential rate actually look like? So if I just do this integral and I put in here the falling exponential, the solution is at the tilde level, just a falling exponential in recoil energy. So what an experiment would actually observe is they'd look for number of scattering events that have given recoil energy, and they'd be plotting the rate for that to occur. And for these sets of assumptions, this rate is just a falling exponential. How would this observation change if the dark matter was actually scattering inelastically rather than elastically? So if I assume that delta here is not zero, how should that curve change?
Should it be a resonance? It should be a resonance.
It should be what?
It should be a resonance at the mass splitting.
Resonance. So let's see here. I'm going to trace out. You tell me what to do, okay? So do I go up? Like kind of.
Sorry. Where?
So.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so...
okay. So when I'm here at high recoil energies, is it much different from the white curve?
No, it shouldn't be. But it's
okay.
Low recoil energies.
Then what's going to happen here?
Some kind of deviation from the curve.
Yeah. What ends up happening is it does this.
Oh.
Okay. Was that not what you were thinking? I thought maybe when you were saying resonance, you might have meant bump, but okay. So if it's inelastic, it looks like this. And the reason is that in this case, I've now increased the minimum velocity by driving up that delta. And so I decreased the number of events I effectively need, I mean, another way to just read this is, I'm going to need more energy in order to be able to kick up my dark matter to the excited state. So most of the scattering events, you won't have anything at low energy, and then it'll look something like that. Okay, so that's just to point out that the specific assumptions that you make about your dark matter sector can actually greatly affect what you'd expect to observe. Okay, are there questions on this? Because if not, I want to move on to sort of how we get from an assumption about how the dark matter interacts with the nucleus to cross-section, how we actually calculate that cross-section, yeah?
Are we assuming, how does the fact that the sun's moving around the magnetic center modify the distribution that you're putting into the velocity there? Surely there should be some directional effect because it's only mass or velocity impacting this
frame. Oh, fantastic, yes. I haven't included that piece of information, but it's, yeah, so it's Maxwell-Boltzmann relative. So the velocity distribution of the dark matter is Maxwell-Boltzmann relative to the center of the galaxy. But we're not in the center of the galaxy, right? We're, 8.5 kiloparsecs away and moving relative to it. So we have to do just a Galilean transformation on all the velocities. Very simply, we have to add in the velocity of the Earth here. Just kind of shifts everything. It's going to actually also shift stuff in the exponent, but you shift all the velocities by that, by the velocity of the Earth.
Well, maybe to the point that this does have a very important physical effect on the manipulation.
Oh yeah, I was hoping to actually get to that at the end. Yeah. So hopefully we'll have time to, because this actually ends up giving a really important observational consequence. So. Okay, so if there aren't more questions on that, what I want to focus on now is how we actually get this cross-section. And the way I'm going to do this is probably not the most standard way of showing this. But I think it's a really nice way of doing the calculation in a very general manner so that you can easily consider very different types of models and things like that. You can all kind of map it onto this formalism. So the idea is just to do the whole thing in a non-relativistic framework. So you start off with some effective Lagrangian that's going to describe how your dark matter interacts with quarks or gluons, but we're just going to focus on quarks for now. Once you have your Lagrangian, then you can determine the effective potential for this interaction. So we're going to do this all out for an example. I'm just going to kind of list out all of the steps first so that you kind of see where we're going to go with this. Once you have this effective potential, and you can solve for this in the non-relativistic limit because it's just non-relativistic scattering, so you have some non-relativistic effective potential for the interaction, then you can determine the non-relativistic matrix element, and this is just using the first order Born approximation. So this is just going to be the following. Where this is the effective potential that you will have solved for in step one. And then once you have your non-relativistic matrix element, the last step is to just get the differential cross-section, which will be related to it as follows. So mass of the nucleon, 2 pi v squared. You do a sum over all of the spins, and then you average over them. So J will be the average, the spin of the nucleus, and then this is the spin of the dark matter. So if you follow these steps, you can pretty much find what this differential cross-section is, given any assumption that you're making for how the dark matter interacts with ordinary matter. And I want to work this out for a couple examples. I'm going to do ones that you'll see most often referred to in the literature. So if you know, what I'm going to do will be what's often referred to as spin-independent interactions. But a really nice exercise to do sort of in your own time might be to just sit down, write down every possible effective Lagrangian you can, describing the interaction of dark matter and quarks, and then work it through to see what the associated cross-section would be. Because it'll be, you know, you can actually get some really different interesting effects depending on what the initial effective scattering interaction is. So for our first example, the notation I'm going to use is just going to be the following. So I'm going to have, here's my dark matter. Capital gamma sub chi is going to be some set of gamma matrices, whatever I want to kind of sandwich in between my chis. And then I can have the same thing for the quarks. And there's going to be a factor out in front. That's essentially coming from the propagator factor. So as a, let's see, let's start off with this example. So if I have dark matter coming in, and then, well, actually no. So dark matter time is this way. So dark matter particle comes in, scatters off of a quark via some mediator, and I'm going to assume that the mediator is heavy for this first case. So for the heavy mediator scenario, and running under the assumption that these gammas are just identity matrices, so I'm going to start off with the simplest possible type of scenario. Then my effective Lagrangian just looks like this. So looking back up at our steps, the first step is going to be to figure out what this means in terms of some effective potential that's felt between the incoming dark matter and the quark that's there. So I can write down the relativistic matrix element as follows. Oh, I should probably put in momenta. Okay. And so to lowest order in the three momenta, the spinners can just, I mean, they just become the following. Let's see if I can write it here. Where the Cs are just the the normalized two component spinners. Okay, so this is in the non-relativistic limit. So I could substitute that in here, and what I end up getting is that in this limit, the matrix element just reduces to the following. So these are just delta functions over the spins of the incoming and outgoing dark matter and the incoming and outgoing, the initial quark and then the scattered quark, right? These here are, these are just relativistic normalization factors that are kind of coming along for the ride. And kind of the most important part that's going to really affect the phenomenology at the end of the day is we're still carrying around this 1 over m squared phi from the fact that this mediator is heavy. Okay, so once we've got this matrix element, very easy to figure out what the effective potential is. So for this particular case, the let me just write this out exactly. The potential for this scattering interaction in terms of momentum is 1 over m squared phi. And I can Fourier transform that to see what I get in the imposition. So in position space, this is just going to go as, I'm going to write it as some constant h1, because we're not going to care too much about the details of that constant, and a delta function in R. Okay? So for this scenario, where the dark matter is mediated by this heavy particle, this is a contact interaction. Essentially, the dark matter doesn't really feel the presence of the quark unless it's kind of right on top of it, right? That's what the delta function is telling us. So at this stage, we can take this and follow the remainder of the steps listed up there. And what you would find is that the differential cross section for the heavy mediator is proportional to the following. And so the important thing to notice here is you get this factor of 1 over v squared, which I had pointed out earlier, kind of comes along for the ride. Now, just as a point of comparison, we can repeat this whole procedure, except this time assuming that the mediator is light. And if we assume a light mediator, then the effect of Lagrangian is going to look a little bit different. For the light mediator case, I'm going to have a 1 over q squared out in front, where q is the momentum transfer, chi bar chi q bar q. And the fact that this coefficient now depends on momentum really will change the story quite a bit. It's not just some constant. So if I just repeat kind of the same steps that I did before, what I would find in this case is that the effective potential in terms of in momentum space is proportional to just 1 over q squared. In position space, So if I Fourier transform that, this is going to be some constant, which I'm going to call L1 over R. So when I have a light mediator, the interaction actually occurs through, it's a long range interaction. And the scattering cross section that I would predict for this case will look different. And in particular, I'll still have this factor of mn over 2 pi v squared out in front. But now I'll have L1 over er squared. So now the cross section has a suppression here coming from the recoil energy of the nucleus. All right. So what does that actually mean, right? So how would we observably be able to tell that we have a heavy mediator versus a light mediator? Let's come back to our definition for the recoil rate. Remember what we did was substitute in here a 1 over v squared for the differential cross section, and then that gives us a factor of v here times f of v. And when we put in the Maxwell-Boltzmann, we find the exponentially falling distribution, right? So this is what we would expect for the case of a heavy mediator. So maybe just take a couple minutes to figure out how this would look different if we had a light mediator instead. How would the differential recoil rate change in that case? So any thoughts? Well, maybe I'll draw two options and then you could tell me which you prefer. That's option one and that's option two. So votes for option one. Okay, votes for option two. Yeah. So, yeah. So, in this case, we'd expect the rate to be suppressed at, it'll drop faster in recoil energy because you have that additional factor of 1 over ER squared in there. Let me just label this. So this is the light mediator case. So again, just another illustration for how different assumptions on how the dark matter interacts with the baryonic matter can significantly affect the expectations for these experiments. So just a few notes. The example I just did out, so the case where we have an effective Lagrangian that's just the heavy mediator case, this is the one that's most commonly discussed in the literature. It's referred to as spin independent interactions. But like I want to emphasize, and I think what this method also emphasizes is that you can choose whatever effective interaction you want, right? So, and different assumptions will give you very different predictions. So for example, if I were to choose the following, right? Totally loud. This is still, this interaction at the end of the day, still spin independent in that it does not depend on the spin of the nucleus. However, d sigma der in this case is proportional to the recoil energy, directly proportional to the recoil energy, okay? So still spin independent, but dramatically different correspondence, right? That would end up changing what we'd expect to measure, yeah?
So is the dark matter energy always small enough that it doesn't resolve the proton, essentially?
No. Yeah, no. I will mention that briefly. I'm just going to finish this list, and then I'll mention that briefly. Okay, another very common interaction that you'll also oftentimes see mentioned in the literature is spin dependent, and that one comes from this. And it's a nice exercise to actually just follow, repeat the same steps we had just done before. If you do that in this case, you'll actually find that your final answer depends on the spin of the nucleus. Okay, so okay. And I should definitely address the question that was just asked, because that's an important point and one that I've kind of glossed over, which is that the nuclei are not point-like from the perspective of the dark matter. So the dark matter does actually resolve the structure of the nucleus. And as a result, you do need to include a form factor that accounts for this. So it's usually written something like this. And it's just that this form factor gets tagged on to the expression for, the reason why I have that proportionality up there for the differential cross section is because there's these additional form factors that come into play. It's slightly complicated to do this in the general form for different types of effective interactions, but totally doable. But yeah, you do need to account for the essentially the structure of the proton.
So are they measured on the lattice and then brought into use?
Yeah. So some of these are coming from lattice calculations. Some of them come from experiments. It's kind of a mix. There, for some of these form factors, there's a large amount of uncertainties. Others are better understood. Mm-hmm. There's a bit of a whole science. It's in there, but something that, you know, one needs to get right, especially in light, if there is a discovery, it's something that could affect the
understanding. So do you need to take this theory and match it onto a theory, an effective theory of nucleons?
Yeah, so essentially the step that I ended up glossing over was the fact that this effective interaction is with quarks, but the actual interaction is between dark matter and the nucleus. So you end up getting matrix elements that, you know, where you sandwich these operators inside of nuclei, initial and final states. And that these matrix elements end up giving you these form factors. Yep.
Also, if you exchange a pseudoscalar, so you just had like chi bar, gamma phi, q bar, gamma phi as well.
Oh, you mean if you if I put a gamma phi here as well?
Yeah, that would also be spin dependent.
I don't remember off the top of my head. We can check it immediately afterwards if you want. But yeah, these have been sort of studied and tabulated. So
yes.
Yeah.
In terms of the limits that we always see, so they always make the first assumption spin independent.
Yep. So the limits we always see are those. That was the next thing I wanted to talk about. Yeah, so these limits that are always shown are making the assumption that it's spin independent. It's this one, spin independent heavy mediator. The reason why this is what, so the this case and this one, the spin dependent one, are the two that you often get in supersymmetry. And so that's why these are the ones that people most often talk about. Yeah, so these are the, this is a compilation of all of the limits. So the way these are limits are tend to be presented is you have the dark matter mass on the horizontal axis. This is the WIMP nucleon cross-section on the vertical axis. In general, the limits tend to be tighter in the energy range from around 50 to 100 GeV. And then the experiments don't tend to have much sensitivity here in this light mass region. Let's see, so what I wanted to say, there were two things I wanted to, comments I wanted to make about this, actually several comments. First is that these experiments use a whole variety of targets. So some of them use xenon targets. So in particular, well, obviously the ones that have xenon in the name, but there's also LUX has a xenon target. Some of them use germanium, so there's a CDMS experiments use germanium. Some of them use like sodium iodine, the DAMA experiment. The blobs at the top. I'll explain why those are blobs and not lines in a little bit. So that was one point. Second point is this region here that's shaded. Is coming from a standard model background that's going to kick in at those very low cross sections. So that standard model background comes from the fact that you just can have neutrinos that scatter off the nuclei. It's clearly a very weak signal, but this is where it starts becoming important. And once that background kicks in, it's going to be a challenge, right? Because there's no way of being able to, that's going to look like dark matter, right? Neutrinos are just some stable neutral particle. They're going to scatter off of the target. And so we're going to have to get a little bit more creative at that point in terms of trying to eliminate the neutrino background and keep the dark matter background, dark matter signal, not background. And the last point I wanted to make and is that oftentimes when you see plots like this, they're going to have blobs that are labeled SUSY or CMSSM or something like that. In this figure, it's shown by this circle here. If you also overlay all of these plots over a span of many years, you'll notice that the blob moves. And in particular, it moves down to lower cross sections. The reason the blob moves is because the way that blob is made is by trying to find the regions of SUSY parameter space that are allowed given all of the experimental constraints that exist, generally speaking. So they absorb all the constraints that are there. So as these experimental limits get tighter and limits from LHC get tighter, it pushes the allowed range down. So I wouldn't generally advise don't really think too much about the blobs. They don't really mean very much. It's much better to think about what these cross-sections mean. And in particular, the point I really want to emphasize is that the experiments right now, the tightest limit right now is coming from the solid line here. These are all projected. The tightest limits are starting to probe a very interesting cross-section. That cross-section is coming from interaction of the dark matter with the quarks via Higgs exchange. All right, so you can just kind of estimate what the magnitude of that cross-section should be. It's roughly around 10 to the minus 45. So SUSY scenarios where you have Higgs exchange, any other kind of model where you tend to have Higgs exchange, will typically end up giving you scattering cross-sections that kind of fall roughly here. So it's very interesting at this point that the experiments are starting to get sensitive to this particular. It's a very well-motivated region. For example, another interesting region would be dark matter interacting with the nucleus via Z exchange, right? If you estimate how strong that should be, it's roughly 10 to the minus 39. So that was excluded a while ago. So if we're focusing on weak interactions, kind of our next best bet is the Higgs. And we're finally at a point where we have sensitivity to that. So I would focus on that more than you know, the blobs that you'll tend to see on these types of figures. Questions on this? Yeah?
Based on the discussion we had like half an hour ago, I would expect to see something like germanium is better than xenon at low masses. Is that something we could see on this plot?
Ah, yes, very good. The hockey stick. Okay, so yeah, let's look at, well, one thing you can see for sure is that, so Lux here has xenon, right, mm-hmm. target. The best germanium limits right now are these ones here. So at high masses, xenon's doing better. And there's a lot of reasons in addition to just the arguments we made there, just experimentally actually just getting larger amounts of xenon and doing controlling backgrounds and things like that, it's easier than doing it with germanium. One thing you can, okay, so you can't really see it that well here, but what CDMS is doing now is really starting to target the low mass region, and so their projected sensitivities are shown here. So the projected, the next run of the xenon experiments are these dotted lines here. So here's xenon 1 ton, and N-ton and Darwin. So their sensitivity is getting really, really good in this high mass region, whereas the CDMS experiments, which are using germanium and also silicon, their sensitivity in the next generation experiments is getting really good here. Mm-hmm. So they do realize that they probably won't win against xenon here, but where they will win is here. So that's kind of the range where they're really targeting. Yeah.
How long is it going to take for these experiments to?
So xenon 1 ton is already being built, and I think going to start getting data by the end of the year. So, you know, a year or two. But I mean, then you know they have to analyze it and stuff like that. So, you know, this is soon. These are in the process of more like a design stage. Things like that. So I think, you know, that'll be longer, probably on the order of more like 5-10-ish years.
So in a few years, these dashed lines kind of be solved.
Yeah, I like your optimism. No, actually, no, there will be discoveries, so they'll be blobs. Yes, not lines. Speaking about blobs versus lines, you will see up here that there are some blobs, and those blobs are coming from experiments that see something that would be, they claim would be consistent with the dark matter signal. So there's the DAMA experiment here, CREST, which I think has now pretty much come to term. I mean, they have a new publication now that says that the events that they were seeing there were not actually events. So we can probably ignore that. There's a CDMS thing there. The challenge here, as you can just see by eye, is the fact that where they claim to see a signal is where other experiments don't see anything at all. And it, you know, makes it hard for, I mean, theorists have thought a lot about whether or not you can have some, so these limits are only for the spin-independent, simple effect of Lagrangian I had written down, right? You can play games by asking what happens if I change that up? How do these change? Can I make different experiments come be reconciled with respect to one another? For a while you could. It's gotten really, really hard, though, as the limits from Lux have continued to get tighter. So I don't know of any sort of very compelling model that can simultaneously explain these possible detections with these limits. But there, you know, you keep them up there because you just never know. Maybe there's something we haven't thought about yet. Yeah?
Given all the sort of dirty nuclear physics that goes into this, to what extent do you actually trust the limits where they're going up by like 6 orders of magnitude or moving 1 GeV in mass? Is there, I mean...
Oh, here, this turnoff?
Yeah, I mean, to what extent do you actually trust the limit?
Yeah, you shouldn't trust too much anything that's very close to the threshold, because also that's where your... So your signal's increasing exponentially, right? And you'd put a threshold cutoff here, right? And any experiment where they don't understand their, you know, systematics very well is always going to be close to their threshold for obvious reasons, right? And the irony is that your signal is exponentially falling, you also expect to have most of your signal at lower energies, which is close to the threshold. So you always need to be really, really careful when the detection is, a claimed detection is close to the threshold. I mean, you can see this by eye here, that most of these anomalies are falling very close to where the sensitivity of the experiments is limited. You could see it falling off, right? By just what you said, the fact that these limits are shooting up there. So, yeah.
Why does neutrino background have such a sharp fall off at around
10 GeV? Oh, so the shape here is being determined from the fact that it's different populations of neutrinos that are causing the scattering in different regions. So these are the beryllium-7, these are boron-8, and then atmospheric neutrinos are there. So the different shape is just coming from which neutrinos are contributing when. I don't have good physical intuition for why this is falling off exactly as it is.
That's the
solar. Oh, so solar was here. Oh, okay, great, good. I learned something. So solar neutrinos and then atmospheric ones there. Okay. So... if there's no other questions on this, I have a few minutes. So I just want to briefly mention this annual modulation signal, which came up in the discussions before. Actually, I'll leave that there. So, yes?
We should also point out that there are analogs.
Yeah, that's a good point. So what I've shown is the one for spin-independent interaction. There's an analog for, what I just erased, the spin-dependent case. Those are the two that you'll most often see plots for. You won't often see plots for sort of these more generic type of interactions, but you can always, if you were interested in a particular interaction, you can always translate one of these limits into what the limit would be, the corresponding limit would be for your interaction of choice. So the last point I just want to make is that you get another interesting effect when you properly include the motion of the Earth relative to the center of the galaxy. So as was already pointed out before, right, when we define, so here's our Milky Way. So when we define our the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, we're defining it relative to the center of the Milky Way. But the lab frame is here and moving around, right? We're orbiting around the center of the Milky Way. And so when we write down the differential rate, we need to properly account for this. And so we need to essentially boost the velocity distribution into the lab frame. So I'm just going to write it like this. And the velocity that we boost by here is time dependent. And the reason why it's time dependent is as follows. So the sun orbits around the center of the galaxy with a velocity that's roughly 220 kilometers per second. And then, let me make this nice and big. So here's the sun. We orbit around the sun with velocity v Earth, which is roughly 30 kilometers per second. So the, yes, and right, so we have this annual modulation, right? Or where, you know, in a year we make it all the way around. So in the frame of the sun, it looks like there's effectively like a wind of dark matter particles, right? Just imagine, you know, you're going from here where you see the dark matter has no coherent motion. But now from the frame of the sun, because we're moving around the center of the galaxy, what we see is this kind of wind of dark matter particles incident on the sun's frame. But then we're here on Earth, right? Our experiment is here and moving around. So when we're roughly here and moving towards this wind, we'll tend to see more high velocity, high speed particles, right? So more high speed dark matter particles, which essentially means a higher flux of dark matter particles. This time of year is roughly June 1st. When we're moving away from this wind, which is 6 months later, then we'll tend to see more low speed particles and the flux is lower. So the net result is that if you look at the scattering rate as a function of time, which you get by just properly putting in here what this velocity is and solving this, you would end up finding that it modulates annually and it has a peak rate in June and a minimum rate in December. So this annual modulation was first pointed out in that Drucker, Fries, Spergel paper that I mentioned, the one that was followed the Goodman and Witten paper. It's an interesting signal because it gives you confidence that if you see something, right, then you would hope to like continue running your experiment for a long period of time such that you could then end up reconstructing this annual modulation. And you would end up seeing if the phase matches what you expect. One of the blobs up there, the Dama blob, the way that experiment is set up, actually, they don't try to subtract out all of their background. And what they try to do instead is just look for a modulation signal. And with their claim being that if we observe something that matches the modulation signal that you would expect from dark matter, that would be signal, and everything else that's not modulation would be background. And so they do claim to see a modulation, but then it's contentious because it hasn't been reproduced and not in accord with the other limits that are there. But it is a very interesting observational signal and could give a much stronger handle on what's going on if a signal is detected.
Yeah. Could there not be a wind of any other cosmic particles as the sun is moving which might cause the same modulation?
Oh, something else that's faking the signal? You're thinking in particular for Dama?
Right, because it's the sun's motion that gives us this wind, right? So that should work for just about anything.
Yes, yeah. So you might also expect to get, there's lots of things that can actually end up giving you an annual modulation. So you can also get it, for example, just from cosmic rays, right? Because as the thickness of the atmosphere changes as a function of time, like over the year, then the amount of cosmic rays making it down to your experiment will change, and that could potentially end up affecting your experiment. And that's what the whole debate is regarding the. I mean, one test you might want to do is essentially repeat the experiment in the southern hemisphere, because if it's dark matter, that shouldn't end up changing anything. But if it's not dark matter, the signal might go away. There's ways that you can get around trying to test for it. But this is there's a lot of debate as to how to interpret the signal. There's one other point I want to make just before concluding, which is that this phase isn't necessarily, so you get this modulation effect from the Earth moving around the sun, but also as the dark matter comes through, it does get warped by the gravitational potential of the sun. So that ends up changing the phase space distribution of the dark matter that you expect to see when you're behind the sun relative to when you're in front. So when you're behind the sun would be March, and when you're in front of the sun is September. So you actually do end up getting a bit of a competing effect between this focusing from the sun's gravitational potential. There's this modulation that should be peaked in March, and you get this other modulation that should be peaked in June. Whichever one ends up winning actually depends on the properties of your dark matter particle. And so essentially the point I just want to make is that these June and December dates aren't set in stone. They can actually change depending on how strong this focusing effect is for your signal. So there's a lot of interesting astrophysics that just kind of goes into this and can affect the signals that you would observe. Same way as there's a lot of interesting particle physics, sort of just working through all of that above, right? You saw that depending on how we change that interaction, the mediator between the dark matter and the nucleon, you can also quite dramatically change what you'd expect to see. So I'm happy to take some more questions. And I think that's most everything I wanted to say about direct detection. And then after lunch, we'll dive into indirect detection. Thank you.